WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Through his years as a hospice doctor, Ira Byock has learned that dying doesn't have to be agonizing. Byock is the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine and directs the palliative care service at the Partners Hospice in Missoula, Montana. He helps people who are dying with their physical pain and also tries to create an environment that eases mental anguish. He writes about the at-home deaths of several of his patients in his new book, Dying Well. He also writes about convincing his terminally ill father to leave the hospital and spend his last few days at Byock's house, surrounded by family. Byock says that dying in the hospital can be a macabre experience.
It's still seen as an unnatural event in a hospital. Hospitals are directed at keeping people alive. Hospitals are palaces of technical expertise, wonderful technical expertise, designed to correct physiologic abnormalities and to preserve life. So again, dying in a hospital is an awkward thing to do, and when it occurs, it always seems to be somewhat of a shock. It's like out of context. So often, particularly in teaching hospitals, and particularly, I don't know that the situation is a great deal better today, but I'm hopeful that it's at least a little bit better. When I was training, however, you could not die in a hospital without having a full court press to keep somebody alive. So very often, even people with end-stage heart disease or liver disease or cancer would be subjected to obviously futile attempts to restart their heart. It was done mostly for dramatic purposes. We all knew that it was futile, but we had to be able to say to the system, if you will, that everything was done to keep this person alive.
Have you thought a lot about how it affects somebody's death to have that kind of intrusive medical procedure done at the moment of dying?
Well, you know, I do think that it is undignified, that we are treating people in an undignified manner when they are obviously just moments away from dying or, in a sense, have already died, and we are still acting as if that's not permissible, as if somehow this very human fact of their mortality is unacceptable to us. So in that regard, it doesn't feel right to me. I look at that transition, that transitus from life to whatever comes next, as a time when people deserve to be honored, loved, even celebrated in this passing. And I think medicine has an important role to play in that. Clearly, that sort of care, which we try to teach and we try here to model in the care that we offer to our patients and families, that kind of care requires more than medicine, but medicine has an important role to play. In so doing, it must really accept the inherent dignity of the human condition, including the inherent inevitable fact of our dying.
You specialize in palliative care, and you say that all pain is controllable. What are some of the latest techniques to control pain?
There are many. The control of pain begins by a careful assessment of what's causing the pain. You know, because somebody has a lung cancer that has perhaps spread to various parts of their body, when I get a call that that person is in pain, the answer is not, well, more morphine or whatever, another drug. Initial response is, what's causing the pain? You know, what makes it better? What makes it worse? Where is it? What are the qualities of the pain? Is the pain today consistent with where the person had a metastatic lesion on a bone scan a few weeks ago, or is it another pain? Is it perhaps muscular pain that we might treat with a physical therapy modality? So analysis is the first step. And although you asked about advances, the advance here is that for so often when somebody has had a terminal illness and is in pain, it has always been assumed, I think, that, well, it's just their cancer again. That is fraught with problems. So firstly, our most important therapeutic tool is the same sort of analytic process that doctors go through all the time in so much of the work that we do. There are medications to be used. Morphine and like opioid medications often have an important role to play. Additionally, we're using radiation therapy in very short fractions, meaning one or two doses, to control bone pain if somebody has cancer that is approachable in that manner. We are using local injection blocks of anesthetics to control pain at times. We're using steroid medications. There is so much that is being developed as far as our pain-reducing protocols. I feel that we are well-resourced at the present time. The real challenge is into bringing this together and really applying it to the goal of alleviating all physical pain.
Everybody has a different threshold for pain. Do you trust people's subjectivity? If somebody says that they're in terrible pain, and to you that might be, you know, pretty minor pain, will you still treat them as if it is terrible pain?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Pain is a subjective phenomenon. A patient's pain is as bad as they tell you it is. Now, in saying that, we don't let people write their own prescriptions. We have a responsibility as professionals who do this work to assess the causes of pain, its various contributions, and to hopefully construct an approach to that patient's discomfort that requires more than just a prescription. So, for instance, if somebody isn't sleeping well, their pain will rise. We know, and it's not a subtle fact of physiology, that sleep deprivation, simply being very tired, decreases one's threshold and makes people experience pain as more severe. So we might change things, whether it's a prescription for a sleeping medication or simply changing the person's bed or the schedule in the home to facilitate their sleep. Similarly, with emotional stress, you know, if there is stress in a marital relationship or a relationship between a person and their child or some other significant other, that will increase their subjective experience of pain. That doesn't make the pain less real, but it certainly changes the way we respond.
A lot of families are dispersed around the country, and I'm sure you've treated a lot of dying people who have adult children who live on the opposite coast or, you know, hundreds or thousands of miles away. And they can't be together during the long process of dying, if in fact that process is a long process. They can't be together for all of that time. What advice do you give families about the dying process when it involves long-distance relationships?
Oh, that's an excellent question, mainly to stay involved, to express your caring and your love, to think about visiting early. Because the quality of visiting can be good. There are more things that one can do when before the illness has progressed to a point where somebody is bedbound or doesn't have the strength to really interact as they otherwise would. So I really encourage people to plan their visits early, to think about what would be left undone if the person were to die today. And think about not only just the fiscal and legal sorts of things that come to mind, but beyond that, what's left undone in this relationship? What would you want the person to know? What would you want to say to that person? I think it's important to realize that this is a high priority in the life of families, that, you know, we all die. You know, death is inevitable, and dying is a part of the life of every individual, but dying is also part of the life of every family. And it is not simply a stressor, but an opportunity for the family that will live on to grow through this experience.
Your father died at your house, but he was sick for months, and you live pretty far away from him during most of that time. What were some of the things you felt you were able to do from a long distance?
Well, you know, I was a doctor even then, and so I could provide some answers to questions that came up. I could provide some suggestions of other resources that they might be able to find in the community in which they lived. I did some calling myself to try to find out more information from doctors or the local hospice program there. It was hard, though, Terry. You know, it's hard to be separate from somebody that you love, who you know is ill and really dealing with symptoms and a serious illness and the emotional strain of this illness.
Dr. Ira Byock is my guest, and he's the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine, and he's medical director at a hospice in Missoula, Montana, and the author of the new book, Dying Well. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Dr. Ira Byock, author of the new book, Dying Well. He's the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine. I think one of the biggest fears of people who are dying is about losing their dignity, especially if they have an illness or a condition that leaves them incontinent. What do you tell people when they say to you, doctor, this is really embarrassing for me, I'm losing my dignity?
Well, I don't say anything right away. I listen, because how could it be otherwise, in a sense? People do feel an inherent sense of embarrassment about having somebody else toilet them and engage in intimate hygiene and the like. I tell them, however, what my feeling is as somebody who cares for them, and that is that, firstly, it's no big deal. It's just part of what we do, and the nurses with whom I work say the same thing. This is just part of caring for people. My other perspective is that they're just human beings, and that at the end of life, we tend to be frail and fragile and physically dependent and in need of care. And that's not inherently undignified. You know, I don't think that people who are physically dependent in that regard are any more undignified than would be an infant or a toddler in such circumstances. What happens when you have those sorts of discussions and sort of explain to people that from our perspective, they're doing what they need to do right now simply by allowing themselves to be cared for by those of us professionals and volunteers who feel drawn to doing this work. By explaining that, people often simply relax and realize that what we're saying has some truth to it.
Do a lot of your patients say to you, doctor, why are you drawn to doing this work?
It gets asked, and you know, I don't have an easy answer for them. It's very satisfying work. For me, it seems natural. People ask hospice people, how can you do this work? The real answer is, from our perspective, how could it be otherwise? How could we not do this work? This is the most exciting clinical work that I've ever done, and as you know, since you've read the book, I've worked in various clinical settings, including 14 years in an emergency department. That's also very satisfying, but it doesn't compare, in my experience, to the opportunity to witness and support people in this just inherently valuable, extraordinary time of life.
I wonder if you think it's wise to try to protect children from death and try to keep them away from the hospice or the hospital or the cemetery.
I think it's an unwise decision. It reinforces this sense that there's something unseemly going on with grandma, or sometimes even with their parents, with mom or dad, because they're ill. You know, there's enough pain around dying without having to hide it and give children the sense that we're ashamed about it. And that's what they understand. We may think we're protecting them from the emotions, but in a sense, we're really protecting ourselves. And we're giving them the impression, since we're, you know, ushering them out of the room and talking in hushed tones, that there's something unseemly or embarrassing happening behind closed doors. I think just the opposite approach is helpful. Allowing children to know in terms that they can understand what's happening here, that their loved one is very sick and likely not going to get better and will probably die. And then allowing them to see our pain, to see that how people honor one another by shedding tears and by being sad, by changing our schedules and doing whatever we can do to be present and helpful. In that way, while children will share our sadness, they will also, I think, develop a healthy model for how human beings care for one another at the end of life.
What are the typical visits from your hospice like? If there is such a thing as a typical visit.
I think every visit's unique, but our program does function under a team model. Often the person visiting is the primary case manager nurse who's assigned to the patient. We often also send in nurses' aides or bath aides to help with patients' hygiene. They may be visited by a social worker or the chaplain, and I'm around to help as a consult to the team as well as to the patient's primary physician. I don't know that there's a typical visit. We tend to act in concert. The nurse and myself often begin by focusing on physical symptoms, but we also are, I think, all of us attentive to the interpersonal aspects of the person's experience with illness and the family's experience with illness, and also to the inherent transcendent or existential issues that come up in people's minds.
You know, it's funny, so much of the healthcare system has gotten away from, you know, the doctor home visit. When I was growing up, pediatrician always used to come to the house, but it's coming back for people who are discharged from the hospital and have nurses visiting at home. It's coming back in the hospice movement.
It certainly is. I find that I learned so much more in the home than I am able to in the hospital. I was trained to work in hospitals, and initially home visits were very foreign to me. And in my years in the emergency department, I certainly appreciated seeing patients there. The chart was ready. I had all the patient's vital signs already recorded for me, and I've got all these wonderful tools and bells and whistles at my disposal. However, now I feel just the opposite. In the home, I can get a sense not only of the patient's symptoms, but also of how they are functioning through their day and their activities of daily living, how they're, you know, where the bathroom is in relation to their bedroom, where their bed is, and, you know, is that in an optimal place for them, all those sorts of things, as well as get a sense of their relationships with the people around them, their spouse and family, but also the people who may come and go in their immediate environment. Perhaps if it's a duplex, the people who live next door, or, you know, the people from down the street. That, all of that, that whole total picture provides me with so much more information that is enables me to make more intelligent and, I hopefully, helpful suggestions and changes in their plan of care.
Do you find that most people who need home hospice care can qualify for it in their health insurance?
Frankly, not. I think, we are trying to cut back on the funding for intensive home care in addition, at the same time that we're trying to get people out of the hospital sooner and more intensive home care is needed. So, you know, we're trying to cut costs on both ends, and in the middle, patients and families get pinched. So often nowadays, we're having to defend the eligibility for comprehensive services that hospice represents to third-party payers. You know, I've practiced in England for a while. I did some hospice work there to learn about how their system works. And I want you to know that although most of the experiences and stresses of dying are universal and part of the human condition, some of the system stresses and the financial worries, the sense of being a financial burden that I hear so often from patients and families, is a particularly American phenomenon. It does not need to be. We know we have enough resources in this country to provide comprehensive pain management and supportive care to patients and families without pauperizing them in the process.
I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
Dr. Ira Byock is the author of Dying Well. He's the president of the American Academy of Hospice and Palliative Medicine.